You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Welcome to CPC Together. This is Brandon Passion and Kevin Sneed. We're coming at you from Foster City, California.
Back in action, coming at you.
Hey, I want to let you know, Kevin, last night I went to an Elton John concert.
That was a sharp shift in tone of voice.
Levi Stadium.
And that place must have been just bumping for Elton John.
It was bumping. That's Saturday awesome. Night and Sunday night.
He back filled to that back. Place. Dang.
And he's 75 years old.
I would not have put him at 75.
He's 75. Crazy. He's like, at one point in the concert, he was like, first of all, the concert was great. And he sounds phenomenal. Yeah, he doesn't look 75.
Yeah.
So I all compliments and that kind of thing. But he did at one point say, what did he say? He said, yeah, you know, I've been on the road for 58 years. Gosh. And it's about time I spend some time with my family.
It's about time.
And I'm like, 75. Man, it's never too late. It's just never too late. Yeah, you know?
Never too late. Never too late to start spending time with your family.
Like, man,
how many miles do you think he's traveled?
Oh my gosh. Well, I know.
That is insane.
I don't know miles, but I know that he said it was like his 203rd California show.
Oh my gosh. Just California.
Just in California.
That is crazy. Absolutely. Had you seen him before? Is he one of your, like, I imagine you have like a bucket list of people to see.
Yeah, he's not on it.
He's not
on it. No, someone offered me tickets, and so Katie and I went with them.
Nice.
And
what was your favorite song you played?
Your song.
Yeah,
I hope you don't mind. I mean, and he just sounds so good still.
It's ridiculous.
And he's a crazy good piano player. So I knew more Elton John songs than I thought I was going to know.
Oh, okay.
I thought I was going to know your song and Crocodile Rock.
Yeah, yeah.
Turns out there's a lot of other ones that I knew also.
That you knew. That's so good.
Rocket Man. And
so who is on your bucket list to see then? If he's not, who's on the list that you haven't seen?
I've never seen the Dixie Chicks.
And that's on your list?
I'd love to see them.
Really?
Yeah.
Man, I feel like a woman.
That's Shania Twain.
Oh, I thought that was Dixie Chicks. What's Dixie
Chicks? You're so embarrassing with your lack of country knowledge. You know, I love to see artists. Wait,
hold on. Let's go. What is Dixie Chicks? What's the...
Because I love going to see artists that are really talented.
Okay.
And
even if you don't like their music or whatnot.
Just because you have a hit doesn't mean that you're good.
Yeah.
And the Dixie Chicks, you know, they don't use all the fancy tuning and all that kind of stuff. They all play their instruments. They do awesome harmonies. And you go as a musician and you're like, that's what's so incredible about Elton. You know, he's still 75. He's been doing this for 58 years.
That's wild.
That's insane. He's 19 years older than me.
Yeah. That he's been touring.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Wait, 21. I'm 39. How many years is that?
Neither of us are math majors. So hold on, who's number that? So Dixie Chicks is really number one on your bucket list?
That's the one,
it's just up there.
Well, I mean, I saw Garth Brooks, who would be one. I've already seen him live, and that was like the best concert I've ever.
That was
been
your
to.
First concert. I just learned earlier, right?
It was my first one, and it was before I was a huge fan of his. But then I went when he did his big comeback tour.
Okay.
And it was, I mean, the whole place was singing at the top of their lungs.
Yeah.
The entire time, it was incredible.
So that's so good.
So yeah, Garth Brooks was great. Obviously, I've seen Michael W. Smith many, many times.
Yeah, of course.
Highlight being the retreat I went on in Asheville, just hanging out with 200 of Michael's greatest fans.
Yeah.
And I was the...
And greatest friends.
That's right.
That's right.
And I was the youngest person by about 25 years.
I was going to say, like, and this is a shout out to my dad, who loves Michael W. Smith and grew up listening to him by osmosis because my dad was listening to him. So anyway, shout out. My dad will be excited to hear that.
Thanks, Mr. Sneed.
Mr. Sneed,
I'm wondering if you want to go to a Michael W. Smith cruise because that's on my bucket list.
Michael W. Smith cruise?
Katie will not go on it because she's like, I'm not going on a cruise with a bunch of people that... are 30 years older than us and listen to Michael W. Smith the whole time. There's just no way. But he does this thing called Smittyoki where you get on stage and he plays his songs. And if you know his songs,
friends of friends forever.
And I have this image of me being like, Michael, can I sit down and actually play them and show you? And you then, sing with me?
And then you guys are...
And he's like, you and I need to hang out, young man.
And you know what? And when we hang out, we're going to let evil go east, but go west, young man.
That's right. There we go. Is that to let evil go east?
Go west, young man. So he wants to go away from evil.
Evil go east. I thought it was don't even go east. Yeah, wow, that makes so much more sense.
Did I just drop Michael W. Smith knowledge on you? Smith's biggest fan?
What about you? What's your go-to?
My bucket list concert?
I know. I already know.
Who?
Bob Dylan.
You do know. I was going to say Bob Dylan. I have not seen Bob Dylan. I would love to see Bob Dylan. Lindsay and I saw at Levi, which is a pretty good venue, by the way, at least for a stadium tour. We saw Coldplay. How many years ago was that now? 4 or 5 years, and it was excellent. They put on a really good show. Other one on the bucket list would be U2. I'd love to see U2 live. When they did the Joshua Tree Revisited tour, we were like so close to buying tickets. I think timing wise, it didn't work out, but I'd love to see U2 and Bob Dylan. I like the two.
Would you say that
Leon Bridges too, for a newer artist? I'd love to see Leon Bridges.
But isn't his music all pretty chill?
It's very different. Yeah, it would be a very different type of...
It'd be like a really laid-back concert.
Yeah. It wouldn't be. And he's not... I imagine he's not filling Levi. You know, it'd be at a small
He's pretty
menu.
Big now, though.
Is he?
Okay. Not I Levi love
his. His, was it Coming Home? So
good. Yeah. Would you say that either of those artists that you behold them? How's that for a transition?
We call that in the business a segue. I behold Senor Dylan.
Yeah. And then soon you become like him and you start
And then
dying.
I become like
Good morning, CPC.
I can't hear that's so good.
But you talked about, I thought it was really interesting, our purpose, sort of our purpose like shifting. Like 500 years ago, we kind of all had this collective knowledge, this collective belief that some sort of deity was you know, kind of at the center of our purpose.
Yeah.
And 500 years later, you know, we're in a completely different situation with the Industrial Revolution. And how has our purpose shifted? Talk about that again.
Yeah. So this is building off some of the work that Charles Taylor's did in, his book, A Secular Age, where again, he talks about the social imaginary and how that shifted. And 500 years ago, it really begins with the Protestant Reformation, which really that begins with the invention of the printing press. So the printing press comes along, Protestant Reformation takes place, which wouldn't have taken place without the printing press, which then eventually rolls into just the technological revolution or the Industrial Revolution.
I have a quick question before you continue.
Yeah.
So the 95 thesis was before the printing press?
It was after.
Yeah. Was it handwritten though?
Oh gosh, now I feel like I need to. I don't think it was typed out. Now I feel like I have to check to make sure that the date. Yeah, it's 14. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Was right. Of course, we both knew that.
We both totally knew that. No need to question that. So then the Industrial Revolution comes in, and what the Industrial Revolution does, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago in my sermon, is it starts to tweak with time. Right, so it inserts machines, which speeds up the production process, which enables us to then move beyond what I said 2 weeks ago, like where production, I stole this from Andy Crouch, but the idea that production was moving at the pace of digestion, so now you can insert a machine that can operate at higher efficiency and higher production. And so when the Industrial Revolution comes on, life itself speeds up. And in that speeding up, What the result is that our meaning now had shifted from away from the idea of finding meaning in the divine or finding meaning in a higher order to now what could you produce and consume and earn, right? Like all of a sudden everything gets kind of monetized in a new, fresh way.
Right.
And so the modern world's all about this pace of life, speed, go, go, go. And so what Taylor says is that the social imaginary had shifted where it moved from the divine into a kind of, again, a collective view of the good that's based on commerce, the selling and trading of items and products. And so what happens then to our meaning is it attaches on to that kind of image of the collective good, and it cuts and it says, you are what you produce, you are what you consume. And those become the driving force of meaning and purpose and identity.
Obviously, that begins eroding at us when all of that starts falling short and we don't, it doesn't mean anything at the end of the day.
And there's a shift from, you know, before the Protestant Reformation and before that for most of history, where meaning was found in the transcendent, right? That which was beyond, that's the divine, right? It wasn't, I mean, obviously the Yahweh, the God of our scriptures, is has a very dominant history throughout the world, of course. But it was still this givenness of the divine, right? Of any religion sort of thing. And so what happens kind of out of that is it meaning and purpose was found in the transcendent, but the Industrial Revolution brought it where it was only found in the immanent, that materiality of things, right? Which, again, isn't bad. We're both material and spiritual. It's not to, we don't want to, that'd be a Gnostic heresy if we divided spirit and material. But what happens is when we find meaning only in the material, only in the immanent, we are placing transcendent desires onto immanent things, and that just crushes them because they're not meant to carry that weight, and it crushes us in the process.
So you read this quote that I absolutely loved, or actually I think it was from an article called I Used to Be Human.
Yeah.
And it talks a little bit about the smartphone revolution, which is crazy to think about, but that's going to be in our history books if it's not.
Oh, yeah.
The smartphone revolution.
I mean,
how drastically these little things have changed our life. Could you read that section that you read again?
Yeah. So this is Andrew Sullivan writing in the New York Magazine, fascinating article. And in there he says, the smartphone revolution of the past decade can be seen in some ways simply as the final twist of this in this ratchet, in which those few remaining redoubts of quiet, the tiny cracks of inactivity in our lives, are being methodically filled with more stimulus and noise. And then a little while later in the article, he says this, he says, and yet our need for quiet has never fully gone away, because our practical achievements, however spectacular, never quite fulfill us. They're always giving way to new wants and needs, always requiring updating or repairing, always falling short. The mania of our online lives reveal this. We keep swiping and swiping because we're never fully satisfied.
Hmm.
And I love that line where he talks about, they always give way to new wants and needs, right? And that's that idea of we're looking for the transcendent in the immanent, because the immanent, the smaller material thing, cannot satisfy a transcendent thing. And so we keep searching the immanent. We keep looking, and it gives way to more different needs, different wants, and we're looking for something to fulfill us. But it can't, because it was never meant to fill eternity that was placed in our hearts.
I think this is what the author was getting at in When You Give a Mouse a Cookie. You know that book?
I do. Yeah. And you're probably right.
It's He's probably tapping into that same milk, thing.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah. And did the same guy that wrote that article, Sullivan, did he write Give a Mouse a Cookie?
Yeah. That was his follow-up to the article was When You Give a Mouse a Cookie.
I thought it was, yeah, and then his follow-up to If You Give a Mouse a Cookie is If You Give a Moose a Muffin.
Yeah, and then he finally wrote The Giving Tree and found out it was all meaningless. He's just cutting away at life.
But what's crazy about that author is...
That was a good foray down to children's literature, by the way.
What's crazy about that guy, though, is he actually checked himself into a monastery, you said, right?
Yeah, to try, and that's how the article opens, is where he talks about placing his phone in a basket or whatever, turning it in. And then he had all these sort of like phantom pangs where he was sensing notifications going off, and which is like a legit thing, right? Like, I mean, how many times have you, if you forget your phone or if you put it away or whatever, you kind of naturally reach for your pocket on occasion, right?
Like, well, let me ask you this. Yeah. What is your line? So you're in San Bruno, you commute to Foster City.
Yeah.
Where's the point on the journey?
Yeah.
If there is one, where you turn around if you forget your phone?
Oh, that's a good question.
Because for me, I'm only in Redwood Shores. If I pull in the parking lot and come into my office, I will still go back out unless go I have back a meeting to get it. And go back and get my phone.
I'll be honest. I rarely ever leave my phone, and that's partly because I plug in directions in traffic every time in the car wherever I'm going, because I live far enough where 101 or 280 could be a more efficient route based on traffic.
I thought you just were confessing that you still don't know how to get from your house to the church. I'm like, man, you should wean yourself
off
of that. It's
been 6 years and I just still need the directions.
No,
I just, and Lindsay makes fun of me every time, but I put in directions everywhere I go. It's like, I just want to see traffic flow.
Because you can,
even
take,
if I know where
you
to
can
go.
Take 280 to 92, or you can take,
or take 101 to 92.
380 to
101. Yeah, 380 to 101 to 280. Yeah.
So, yeah. But the thing that jumped out at me there in that article, any cracks of inactivity are being methodically filled with noise.
Yeah.
That, I mean, I don't know that has ever been more true right now, and that our need for quiet never goes away, and we keep swiping and swiping and we're never satisfied. It's like, oh man, if you've got to be, almost anybody in this world right now has got to be listening to this and thinking, I resonate with that.
Yeah. It could be the reason they're listening to us right now. It's filling a crack of silence for this, but we've all done that. I mean, we all feel that. And it's, the noise there is obviously kind of, think of it writ large. It's not just actual audible vibrations in your ear noise. It's reading, it's consuming, it's listening. It's all those things create a sort of external noise where we just avoid the very thought of like silence, and so it's, we fill every nook and cranny with it, which is new historically. We haven't always had access to do that. And so how then do we,
I mean, even in like my childhood, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but boredom.
Yeah.
Like I remember being bored a lot.
Yeah.
And that's like literally the worst thing that you could do to a child now is that
like
they
you'd
would
be on
bored.
A family road trip, when you're younger, like driving to Iowa or whatever,
that's
and you're
right.
somewhere near the salt plains and you're just like looking out the window for the fourth hour in a row, right? With nothing to do. We just don't have those spaces anymore.
I remember the biggest game changer was the Game Boy.
Oh, I had a Game Boy. Kirby's Dream World.
Yeah,
I loved that game.
But I had the original Game Boy that didn't have a backlit screen.
Oh,
you could get a like a magnifying glass.
Yeah.
And then it had a light on it.
I had the same one. Yes.
But
my grandma
then,
got me that.
You couldn't really see, like once it got dark, it was kind of garbage.
No,
it was
no
so
dice.
Hard.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's crazy how,
There's another quote I've used often by Ronald Rollheiser, and he says that he has this great line that it's like haunting. He says we're distracting ourselves into spiritual oblivion. And he says because we fill every moment of silence with noise, we're distracting ourselves into spiritual oblivion because we just don't have the ability to give an attentiveness to God.
And so we all feel that. We all feel when we read a quote like that. We all feel this sense of like, oh yes. I resonate with that.
Yeah.
And yet we remain captive to it.
Yeah.
And you even compared a little bit to like Stockholm syndrome, where we keep returning to it, even though we know, what would be, I was thinking about this, what would be the consequences? Sometimes I think that like when we think about leaving this productivity machine, when we think about sort of removing ourselves or reorienting our schedule and our life, maybe something practical, like we think about, okay, what if I just take a Saturday and do a Sabbath?
Yeah.
And these fears just come into our brain. I think sometimes when we think about that fear, it can almost be like an irrational fear.
Mm.
And what I do with my family, and I think they hate me for this, is I just say, let's go down that rabbit hole. Let's just see like what would happen.
Yeah.
So Sabbath may be a great opportunity because you've been down this road. So like when you first started this journey of Sabbath, which you've been doing now for what, 3 years?
Oh no, we've been doing it for, we started it now, we're like 7 or 8 years now.
Wow,
we've
really?
Doing it. Yeah.
So
and it's ebbed and flowed. It's not always been perfect, but pretty consistently.
But do you remember when you first started, when you first decided and you first were contemplating giving up a Saturday?
Yeah.
What were some of your fears and thoughts?
Honestly, the first fear was a little bit of what we're talking about. Like, what are we going to do? you know, like, what do you do with that much time for nothing? You know what I mean? And it's Sabbath is far more than doing nothing. We'll talk about that in the spring. But it's like there was a genuine fear of like, what, I'm going to get bored and I don't know how to be bored. And so what am I going to do? I think there was that. There was definitely a fear of missing out, right? Like the whole world seems to be doing things. And obviously, again, we'll break this down further in the fall or the spring, but Sabbath is about being with people and worshiping with people in a Sabbath community, all that kind of stuff. But initially it was that fear of like, what are we going to have to cancel everything on Saturdays or whatnot? And so that became a big thing. And then it was just kind of the unknown. Like we didn't know what this was going to do, if it was going to work. Like it felt like a lot of effort. And so, but we had to at some point just give ourselves over to it and just step into it and just kind of trust that God would do something with it. I think those are kind of our primary fears around that.
Yeah. And I think when we think about our captivity to this like intense need to be efficient and to be productive and all that kind of stuff, when we think about that, it can apply way more than to way more than just trying to make a Sabbath. This is like when you engage this stuff, not being productive, not being efficient, you're going to suffer consequences in the world.
And that was another, I think, a big fear of just who am I if I'm not working? You know what I mean? Like there was that sense of when I step away from work for 24 hours and fully disconnect, it's like, who what is my identity? Right. And I don't think that was a fear going in, but I think after a while that became kind of what God was uprooting in us was you're more than your work. You're more than what you produce and you're more than what you consume. And so when you disconnect from that machine, it's a, you know, it's vulnerable because you don't know who you are. So that certainly was a fear that developed is, and that I think honestly was a good thing. So God was bubbling to the surface to allow him to heal and to do some work there.
So you said that we are, and you said this a lot, so I'm thinking this is maybe your main point, but
yeah,
that we become what we give our time to.
Yeah. Our attention.
Yeah,
we become what we give our attention to. Yeah.
And I immediately thought of like married couples that I know.
Yeah, yeah.
That become over the years, you're like, man, like each other. You guys are perfect for each other. You're like the exact same person. Like, what the heck? You cut your hair the same. You do all.
Totally.
That's an exaggeration. But like, you know, or you'd mentioned like the people in their.
When they start looking like their dogs.
Yeah.
And their dogs start looking like it, which. Which is not good as a new dog owner of 9 months or whatever it is. So that's not good.
Let's hope that, what's your dog's name again?
Winston.
Let's hope that Winston starts looking like you.
Oh my goodness. Lindsay just got him groomed again and we didn't want to pay for the grooming soon. So we cut it short. He looks so ridiculous. He looks awful. but no, it's true. We do. We become what we give our attentiveness to, right? And I think, again, you see this so clearly with kids or young people because they just don't hide it. You know what I mean? Like think of whether it's your kindergartner or whether it's your middle schooler, right? They both have that same impulse where when they spend time with someone or something, they slowly over time embody that. Like I'll never forget.
Or not so slowly.
It happens quickly. But I'll never forget when my oldest, she used to love the movie Little Mermaid and she would watch it over and over and over again. And what you don't realize until your daughter starts watching it over and over again is that the whole movie is about a daughter rebelling from their dad.
Yeah.
That's like the whole thing, right?
That they don't reprimand their daughters.
Exactly. And so she like was just embodying this movie, right? And over time, like, she slowly starts acting this out with me, like just in subtle ways. And I was like, we got to stop watching this movie. But it was the same thing. She was becoming what was consuming her attention because it's just how we're wired.
This is probably why my mom wouldn't let me watch Simpsons.
It probably is. Mama Passion was smart. Yeah. She knew.
I was like, come on, man. What's the big deal? But yeah, I think that this is something that to your point, we see, it's easier for us to see in other people,
yes,
than to see it in ourselves.
Yeah,
almost like when you're, you know, trying to lose weight or you're working out or whatever. Like, you don't see the change like other people do.
Yeah,
like, but But this is something, there is a very real thing that happens.
Yeah.
And a shift that you see. And like you said, it's exaggerated with kids. And actually that's a little bit terrifying to think, you know, how much our kids are consuming stuff on YouTube and all that kind of stuff. It's like, this is shaping their little minds around something that is, that is not God.
Yeah. And this is what I was trying to bring out, on Sunday, was just, there's so much, you know, when you look at, and this is, Jonathan Haidt, I can't remember how you say his last name, wrote an article about the connection between, essentially the rising anxiety and, kind of outrage culture that we live in, and tying that as a, not quite a direct connection, but a correlation with the rise of social media. And in the article, he just talks, he actually calls it the modern day Tower of Babel, which is fascinating. But in the article, he talks about, how, you know, or he's not, I'm sorry, I'm reflecting on the article, and what he's drawing the connection to is when we are giving our constant attention to something like social media, it then knows, like, it makes money off of our attentiveness. Hmm. And so when it's that old, you know, if, I don't know if you saw Tristan Harris, The Social Dilemma, that documentary that,
no,
like,
I was too scared,
took over Netflix. Yeah. I haven't watched it actually either, but I've read a bunch of his stuff and I should watch it. But in there he talks about, like, listen, if something is free, if a you know, social media service or whatnot's free, you're the product, you're the thing they're making money on. And so they know, like, if they can hold your attention, there's high stakes for that. There's a lot of money to be made or whatnot on that. And so they find out that something like fear and anger goes viral quicker, that we're responsive to that. Mm. And so when they begin to kind of, or systems or whatnot begin to take shape around that idea, no wonder then you look at a culture whose attentiveness is kind of there, that we're becoming more angry, more fearful, more anxiety ridden.
Wow.
Because that's, we're becoming what we give our attention to. And I think you see this again. I think this is what's so devastating about the sort of, I don't even know if we can call it a burgeoning mental health crisis or just a full on mental health crisis with the younger generation, is we're seeing the very kind of outrage culture that we see play out online and the fervor all around that. It's manifesting in our kids. It's manifesting in us as adults. And it's becoming the thing that we well know, like, none of us want that. Like, we don't want to be angry and fearful, but yet it tends to come up in us. And I love that what you said earlier is that the tendency for us is to project that onto others and think that's their problem. Mm. At least I'm seeing reality right. Right. But there's this sort of kind of confirmation bias that we have, thinking we're out of the fray, but we're not. We're right in the midst of it as well. And so we have to hesitate when we start pointing the finger at saying that it's a bummer that they're stuck there. We probably have to do some internal work to recognize, we too are consuming that and it's shaping us.
And this really is what you were talking about when you talked about the attention economy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
How scarce resources are distributed, and thinking about our attention as a finite resource.
Yeah.
You know, which is absolutely true. I mean, 100%, we don't think of it that way, but like you said, we feel this more than ever right now. And I think, you know, as someone who occasionally is a content creator, trying to get my music into the digital space or, a show or whatever, like, you don't realize the level, the magnitude of how many people are fighting for an attention of all of our attention.
Yeah.
Until you try to put something in that space and it disappears.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's just massive amounts of, I mean, that's where we live, industry.
Yeah.
Built around, how do we get someone's attention? Yeah. How do we cut through the noise? Hey, I have a formula. I have an algorithm. I have a thing.
Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't address the main issue, which is we're pulled in every single direction.
Yeah.
And that pulls us away from the thing our heart is truly longing for.
Yeah. 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 It's so good. And it's so, again, like, frightening in some ways, because we, this is the idea, right, that we talked about earlier in the series around, like, when you just wake up, the world is shaping us into a particular mold and a particular angle of who we are or who it wants us to be. And we have to resist that, right? Because that's that natural sway is towards a particular image of the good life.
Mm.
And if we don't find ways to resist that kind of social imaginary, that commerce laden worldview that says this is everything you are, is what you produce and consume. We just get sucked into it. You know what I mean? It's exactly like you're saying. There's so much out there that it's just like a little drop in the bucket. It just permeates everything about our world.
Let me go on silent mode here.
Yeah. Oh, geez, Brandon.
Focus mode. That's ironic.
Isn't it ironic?
Is it?
Don't you think?
Is it do not disturb?
Yeah. Do not disturb.
All right.
I feel like we should leave that in because that kind of fits. <It does. laughs> Someone's vying for your attention
exactly,
right now.
Exactly, man. So David had a solution.
Yeah. Yeah.
To his enemies, to the darkness, to the problems.
Yeah.
And he says, one thing I ask, one thing I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord and seek him. So you kind of broke it down into two different words.
Yeah.
Dwell.
Yeah, which is yashab, is the Hebrew word.
And talk about the meaning of that. It's similar to...
It's similar to remain and abide, that word meno. We looked at last week. Yeah, meno. And it's the idea, again, of if you think about... I mean, maybe it actually... What would have been a good metaphor for Sunday is thinking through, we dwell online, right? We spend time there. We, in some ways, have a home there. We set up our life there. And to dwell then in the house of the Lord is to say, okay, how do I sit in, resonate with, abide in, remain in the presence of God? And we have to think of this, again, don't take it literal. And it's poetry, right? So don't take it in the literal, I have to be at 1005 Shell Boulevard all the days of my life, right? Like the church building, right? It's not that.
Oh, it's not that.
It's not that. It's
okay,
not
then
that. You were here early, though. You were getting ready to dwell.
Yeah, I was. All right. That'll be a relief to my family. Yeah. Right?
But it's like, how do we remain in the presence of God at all times? Grocery shopping, you know, at your job, commuting in traffic, you know, whatever it is, at the dinner table with a friend, whatever. Like, how do we rest and reside in the very presence of God at all times? Because when then, like if we dwell in the digital world and that slowly becomes who we are, it inscribes itself into us, then to dwell in the house of the Lord, we'll do the same. We dwell in there. It's the water we swim in. How do we change out the water we swim in, right? Like how do we allow that to be the kind of default setting of our life so that that begins to inscribe itself within us. And that's the task. And David, you know, again, he was so emphatic about the one thing, right? This is it. Amongst all the chaos he had going on, the one thing that he wants is just to dwell in the house of the Lord.
Yeah. And you used this, used your sponge analogy again, that we are meant to be permeated with the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're meant to have the Holy Spirit in God's presence dwelling.
Yeah. Saturating
yeah,
us.
Yeah, saturating
through us.
And I just started thinking about, it actually kind of broke my heart a little bit, thinking about the things that we permeate our lives with that we were never meant to permeate our lives with.
Yeah.
And what that does really to us and to our relationship with God, it's like we completely miss how we were designed. And it's no wonder why we sort of walk around feeling hopeless and feeling fearful and
swiping and swiping, never fully satisfied.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And what's unfortunate is so many of those particular things that we try to find identity in, you know, whether it's money or power or sex, those are kind of the top ones we always talk about, is when we're permeated by the Holy Spirit, it's not that those things are worthless. It's not that they don't have meaning in our life. But it's when we're permeated with the Holy Spirit, when we're dwelling in the house of the Lord, those things find their proper ordering. And then we actually experience them more fully in the way they were designed as well. And so we experience resources and positions and sexuality in a way that allows those things to actually flourish in our life, opposed to trying to make them do more than they were ever intended to do.
The end.
Yeah.
The other word is huzzah. Which I think I've heard that before.
Yeah. Huzzah! Yeah, yeah, I think it's actually a different word because I looked into that. But I think it's actually a huzzah.
You okay. Get the but it means to behold, to gaze on, to gaze?
Yeah, to like gaze that. On the beauty of the Lord. Yeah, and so it's that idea of like, imagine just like almost like, maybe, you guys ever go to MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in the city?
No.
Okay. Lindsay, I go on occasion. We're not that high flouting. So when I say that, don't think we are, but we're members there who we support it and we go there. It's fun. But
do you have your name on the commemorative wall?
I don't know. I didn't get my name on the wall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think you have to do more than just be the bottom rung of the membership, but they gave me a card that has my name on it.
Nice.
But anyway, like when you go to an art museum, right? Like what you're doing is you're walking around and you're watching people behold art. Mm. They're standing there. They're looking at it. They're staring at it. They're spending time with it. Like all that sort of thing, because you notice more about it, right? When you slow down than when you're just scrolling across your phone or whatever, and it's just pops up or something. And so it's a similar idea. Like what David is saying is I want to dwell in the house of the Lord. And then in that, the purpose of that is so that he can just spend time beholding the beauty of God. And when you behold that, that transforms like the way we think, the way we process, the way we even just see the world around us, right? If you're beholding, a particular, let's say like a news outlet, right? Who knows that what bleeds leads, right? Is the old adage. Like, so they're going to project the worst news possible, swing it in a particular way. That's going to be the way, like if you are constantly consuming that, you're just going to look out on the world and it's going to appear like it's on fire all the time. Whether or not that's in reality or not, it doesn't matter. That's what you're beholding. And so David is saying, gosh, I want to behold the goodness of God, because in that beholding, the goodness of God kind of begins to permeate me. And from that comes a life that flourishes out of the goodness of God, not out of the outrage and frustration and the fear and the anxiety. So how do we then learn to behold God kind of throughout our days?
I feel like having a teenage daughter is illuminating to me in a more real sense the direction away from beholding that our world is going.
Yeah.
Just because like we were driving home and she was talking about, you know, volleyball stuff, and
yeah,
I think she made a comment about how she doesn't want to keep score because she has the worst attention span in the world, and you know, was kind of making fun of herself or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like, Olivia, you know, lecture mode.
She loves lecture
mode. You need to think about your attention span as like a muscle.
Yeah.
I was like, you can think of it like you got to grow it.
Yeah.
And if you don't grow it, you're just going to be at will.
Yeah.
Pay attention to whatever comes in front of you. And she's like, nah, I don't want to. And I'm like, oh no,
I'm good.
But you know, that idea that we just kind of go out and pay attention to whatever catches our eye, like you said, like we're in for a world of fear and hopelessness and whatever is, it's not all the good things that, that catch our attention first. So this idea that we can actually change what we behold. We can actually decide, like what David is saying, what we can behold in a world that maybe, it feels like maybe they don't really, like we don't, not they, we, all of us, don't, we're moving away from beholding in general.
Or our beholding is becoming these, like, I don't know, whatever, however long a TikTok thing is, like 6 seconds or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like they flip through so fast. And this is what I think is hard about, particularly next week when we launch The Habit of Silence and Solitude. I think what most people are going to run into when they start this practice is when they sit down to just rest in the presence of God and behold God, is they're going to find that their body slows down, but their mind just races past it. And their mind will just be chasing after things. And it's nothing other than the exact way our brains have been trained to do that. Because that's the world we live in, where we have this diminishing attention span. And so it's one of the obstacles that we have to push through. And your advice to Olivia is actually really good. Like, it is a muscle. It can be developed. And the Holy Spirit can break some of those strongholds over time, where you begin to be able to rest more and more in the presence of God. Or as that Willard quote I use, that, you know, we can direct and then redirect our minds back to God. And slowly, it's like a needle of a compass pulling to north. It just begins to happen.
What would you call that lack of attention span? It wouldn't be hurry.
I think it could be. I think it's the result of something like hurry. Yeah, hurry and distraction. That's like going back to Sullivan's article. He uses the phrase distraction sickness.
Mm.
He says like we're ill from
distraction.
Constant distraction.
Yeah. So because you gave kind of three reasons why.
Four reasons.
We no. Oh. No, I'm not there yet. You gave kind of two reasons why we don't behold.
You gave three, no, four. Nah, you gave two. Okay.
You gave two, and then I'm adding a third.
Nice.
The third that I'm adding is, I think right now in our world especially, distraction is a big reason why we don't behold God.
Yeah.
But you also mentioned that sometimes we don't behold him because we actually maybe don't realize how beautiful he really is, and that we project our wrong image of God onto God, and we say, well, if he's that,
why would I want to behold him?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Gosh. And that's the one that's so heartbreaking. And I feel like I'm constantly learning this too, of taking, like we project so much of our pain onto God. Some of that inscribed for unjust reasons, but valid in the sense of like we're carrying that brokenness with us. And often that gets into our view of God, of God has inflicted this or God is causing this. And so we get this distorted image of God, which then again, that's where when we behold that distorted image of God, we begin to enact that distorted image, right? And so of course we wouldn't want to behold God, because in that image, that flawed image, God is, you know, some sort of tyrant, some sort of bad father that's just waiting for you to screw up. And that's devastating, right? Because we, because it takes some work to like think of God properly, right? And it takes a lot of unlearning. And again, a lot of this is from valid reasons, like in the sense of like real pain and trauma that happened. And this is something actually I said Sunday that I didn't get a chance to say on the recording that we posted. Is, you know, one of the graces of God that he desires in this is when we behold him, all these things begin to come to the surface, and then that's how they're dealt with. And so whether it's, you know, the grace of God giving, you know, the ability of a therapist to work through childhood wounds with you, those sorts of images that you project onto God come from somewhere. Hmm. And God's equipped people in the body to help work through those things. And so, that idea of like, if God's a bad image, of course we don't want to behold him. But God wants to heal that. He wants to heal that image.
And he wants us to invite him into,
into the pain.
Our scars and wounds.
Yeah, into the pain. Yeah, he's not wanting to inflict it or punish or that. He wants to heal those things. He wants to bring wholeness to that.
Going back to the Willard quote, the first and most basic thing we can and must do is to keep God in the front of our minds. Mm.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely.
And he calls it the fundamental secret for caring for our souls. Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
So how do we behold? You gave us some practical tips. Walk us through the four real quick as we close here.
Yeah. Yeah. So the first I said, we have to create margin, right? And this is just that idea that we're just too busy to follow. I mean, so many of us live at such a pace that we just crowd out any opportunity to behold God. I mean, again, go back to maybe the art museum example, like to behold a painting or whatnot, you have to stop. You have to look at it.
You can't spend time at an art museum in a rush.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
if you're just like blitzing through the floors, like you're not going to actually appreciate what's there. You may catch something along the way, but we have to create margin for that depth of transformation to happen. And so two of the ways that we've talked about that we're going to be laying out this next year is this idea of silence and solitude, and we're going to practice that as a church community. And then Sabbath in the spring, these very practical spiritual disciplines the church have been doing for centuries that have helped cultivate a life that creates margin in your day to slow down and be attentive to God. And the second one is this idea that we have to embrace boredom and slowing.
Yeah.
Again, everything in our world is like against, like boredom is the like, chief sin in our world. Like, how could you let yourself be bored? But what we find again, when you slow down and create that margin, is oftentimes you have to embrace the fact that it may be a little bit boring. But in that, we trust that God is actually moving and working. It's when you least want to go to the gym, and then yet you still put your shorts on and shoes and go to the gym. Like that's probably a bigger win because you're doing a transformative work that's saying the gym's important.
Mm.
right? So even in that boredom, when we keep showing up, that's all. I mean, you can't be necessarily like good or bad at Silence of Solitude. You just show up to it. And in that, we recognize, yeah, it's going to be a little bored. It's going to feel everything in us, because the modern world just preaches boredom as the chief sin. Like, we're going to want to push away, but we just have to embrace that and say, you know what? It's okay to slow down. It's okay to be a little bored. That'll happen.
And you mentioned that those first two, you mentioned that those first two are about, what makes it hard is we don't want to release control.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
You know, when you sit in that, like you said, it's God that does the work in that.
Yeah.
It's not us. And we just sit there. Wait, you just want me to come and sit there?
Yeah. And it's like, that's been, I think as I've now for about a year or so, maybe a little more than that, started practicing Silence of Solitude and trying to cultivate that in. That's the thing that seems to always come up. It's like, I just have this tight grip of control on so many things. And even on like my growth as a disciple of Jesus or an apprentice of Jesus, like, I want to control it. But in silence, you have to just let go. You can't control it. You just show up and you just sit there and you kind of wait on God. And so you have to release all that control.
So number three.
Yeah, number three, practice the presence of God. And this is, again, ripped off from Brother Lawrence, 17th century monk, who essentially set out. He wrote this little tiny beautiful pamphlet, which I know I've seen. I talked to a few people on Sunday who have read that or have it on their nightstand. I just saw someone earlier this morning who had it with them after this one. They're like, I got to read it again. It's a great, beautiful little book where he essentially sets out to say, I want to think of God throughout my entire day. I want to keep God before my mind. And he just was finding these ways in which, whether he was doing dishes in the monastery, whether he was in deep prayer or at the Eucharist table, where he would catch him, or he would intentionally remember he's in the very presence of God. And so he called that practicing the presence of God, is over throughout your days, remembering you're in the presence of God. So it's about finding little, you know, like hacks or whatnot in your life to just draw your mind to God. It's like the one I said is, you know, usually before I go into a meeting or whatnot, it's a simple prayer that just says, God, you're here and I'm here. And it's a simple way to just practice the presence of God and remember that. And so, you know, that could look a thousand different ways, but it's throughout your day, however you kind of find it.
I do breath prayers.
Do you?
Yeah.
Nice.
Like, Father.
Nothing brings you into the presence of the Lord better, you know?
inward singing. The last one, all of this is in grace.
Yeah.
That God has been beholding you this whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the simple, like, reality that, at least what I found is, when we enter in, when we behold God, we finally see that loving embrace of God. And so all of it is grace. All of it is a mere response to God beholding us, of God looking on us, God moving towards us. And so in that, I think it gives freedom to try this and to practice it and to not be legalistic about it, but just to recognize all of this is beyond our control. And all we're trying to do is, by the grace of God, dwell in the house of the Lord and just behold God a little bit more. And what we find again is that God the whole time has been beholding us.